Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this, the second of two Radio Curious interviews with Lawrence Gonzalez, author of Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why, and Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, we explore how human mental scripts and genetic predispositions can be better understood and thus applied to current issues. According to Lawrence Gonzalez, we are each predisposed to follow our own mental scripts as we learn them over time. Therefore, how can we interpret the behavior of our politicians? For example, examining the recent election of Barack Obama. And how can this learning be applied to other conflict situations? This interview, recorded on January 19th with Lawrence Gonzalez from his home near Chicago, Illinois, we began by exploring some of the issues brought up in part one of this series about the altered state of consciousness that can be entered into when concentrating deeply on work or a project. Lawrence Gonzalez, welcome to part two of our interviews about your books, Everyday Survival and Deep Survival, here on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
When we closed our last interview, you were talking about altered states of consciousness when people focus on specific work. Can you describe that for us and what your thinking is?
Yes, I'm writing a book about writing, actually. And I'm writing it from a point of view that's quite different from other books on writing. I'm writing about how the brain functions to process words and how that influences the effectiveness of writing. And so I've been reading all of these things about language processing in the brain, and along the way what I've found is that almost all writers who write extensively describe this state that they go into when they're doing their best work. And it's a state of where they lose track of time, and they lose their ability to process sensory input, so it's like the world kind of goes away. So it's not quite a trance, it's sort of a hypnotic state of sorts, and very difficult to describe. Most people don't have good words for it. But evidently, based on the neuroscience that I've been reading and so forth, it is a place where you can gain access to the unconscious levels of the mind that are always working, but that we never really know about.
Can you give us some examples of those unconscious levels of which we're unaware?
Yes. The part of the brain that we think of as doing the logical thinking is the neocortex and the frontal lobes and so forth. You know, if you're doing something that requires step-by-step attention, that's where the work is being done. But there's all kinds of other stuff going on below that level in the limbic system, which processes emotional information. So, for example, there are lots of people in New York City who I've heard say that whenever they go out and it's a really nice, beautiful blue sky day in the fall, they get this sense of anxiety. And the reason they get that sense of anxiety is because that's what it was like when the World Trade Center was attacked. That was the kind of day it was. And because of the extreme emotional impact of the attack on the World Trade Center, they formed a connection in their emotional system between this clear blue sky weather and something bad happening. So this is one of the ways that we tag the world for meaning unconsciously as we go through our lives from the time we're little. We build up this library of emotional tags for everything.
Based on an initial or primary experience that was remarkable.
Yeah, that had emotional impact of some kind. And that could be as simple as, you know, if you loved being in first grade and the cafeteria smelled like roast beef, you know, you might forever have this association between the smell of roast beef and something good. So we form all these kinds of different associations at a subconscious level that give us things like taste, you know, taste in food, taste in music. It's one of the reasons, for example, that a smell can take you back to a time long ago that you remember fondly or not so fondly. So there's this whole emotional life that's below the level of consciousness that plays a very important part in shaping our behavior. In fact, the neuroscientists now believe and can demonstrate in the lab that what we do when we behave is we do something and then we make up an explanation about why we did it to keep the story of our life coherent. And Steven Pinker, famous psychologist who writes about language in the brain, calls this the baloney generator in the brain, that basically the explanations we give for why we do the things we do are nonsense, that the emotional system is the source of most of our behavior, and it's unconscious. So when I'm talking about these altered states, I'm talking about a state in which a writer or a scientist or someone, some other artist, gains access to that hidden area. That area that's hidden from consciousness suddenly becomes accessible. I noticed this in my own writing. When I wrote Deep Survival, for example, I finished the book and I looked back at it and I thought, like, wow, who wrote that? That, you know, it doesn't feel like I wrote it. It feels like someone else wrote it. And I can't really even remember having written certain things in it. And this is what, now that I'm investigating this to write a book about it, it's what I'm finding lots and lots and lots of artists and writers say. They look back at their work as if it came from somewhere else.
Going back to your work and your review of it, what feels different?
Well, it's just really that I read, you know, the best, what I consider to be the better passages, say, in Deep Survival, like the very ending, which is sort of climactic. And I can't connect emotionally with having written that. I mean, I can't even remember writing it. I remember thinking about writing it, and I remember when it was written, when it was finished being written. But during the process of actually writing it, I don't have a specific memory. And I know now why that was, because I was in an altered state of consciousness while I was doing it. And what you do in that altered state of consciousness is you get to go into that place where the emotional system does its processing, which is hidden from consciousness most of the time. So you leave the world of regular thought and you enter this subterranean world, and that's where you do this work.
So that happens on two levels, I would suggest. One level is on that of the writer or the producer of the words, and the other level is on that of the listener or the reader of the words.
Right. If you're successful as an artist, then you are able to transmit to the person just what you experienced. And so, I go into some of this in the book, Everyday Survival, the way people share their emotional experiences unconsciously. People begin to mimic each other, and by mimicking each other, they feel what the other person is feeling. And they actually coordinate body movements and breathing and things like that until they both are in the same emotional state. Well, it's much harder to do that. I mean, people do it face-to-face all the time. It's much harder to do that, though, with music or with writing or some art form like that. But when it's successful, that's what's happening. The person is picking up these emotional signals through the writing and synchronizing with you, and then goes into that altered state that we're talking about.
So let's then apply that to Barack Obama, who tomorrow will be inaugurated as President of the United States after a campaign that is substantially different than most any of the others that we've seen here in America.
You know, one of the things that Barack Obama has that I think contributed a huge amount to his success is what people call charisma. And if you look at it from the point of view of the brain and how these emotional systems that we've been talking about work, you begin to understand what happens. He is a guy who is very easy to synchronize with in terms of emotion. He has the body language, the expression, the inflection of voice, all of these things that people pick up on and mimic naturally. He's just very, very good at those. And so when you see Barack Obama, not everyone, but plenty, enough people to elect him, let's say, you synchronize with him and you pick up on his emotional state, and his emotional state was genuine. So not only was he not just a lying politician, but really believed what he was saying, but he was able to communicate that belief through this emotional contagion that I'm describing. And I think that, more than anything else, could be the cause of his success. Now, he did have a very disciplined, well-run campaign, and they used a lot of new tools like the internet and text messaging and all that were part of the package. But without the guy, without the actual human being to emotionally synchronize with, you wouldn't have had that kind of success. Ronald Reagan was like this. He had the ability to look you in the eye and make you believe that he believed, And it's all about this emotional synchrony that I'm talking about.
Whereas John McCain didn't have it to the same extent.
I don't think John McCain had it much at all, to tell you the truth. I mean, I like John McCain, but I don't think he had that kind of charismatic emotional contagion that Obama had. There are lots of presidents who didn't, Nixon certainly wasn't that way. So there can be a lot of other factors that influence a presidential election.
Yet we find Obama reaching out to McCain, and in fact this evening at one of the night before the inauguration balls, McCain is one of the guests of honor.
Well, I believe Obama is really genuine, and it's hard to beat that. You know, people have this experience all the time in small ways with other people. You know, when you meet someone and you just click, what you're doing is you're synchronizing your emotional systems readily with this other person, and you believe the other person is telling the truth. The other person's not concealing something from you. When you meet someone and you just don't feel comfortable with that person, you can't get comfortable with that person, it's a failure of emotional synchrony that's the cause, either because the person's just bad at synchronizing or because the person's trying to conceal something from you or deceive you in some way. So it's a very powerful social communication channel.
I'd like to take that example that you just gave from a one-on-one encounter to a culture-to-culture encounter. But first, I'd like to say that on this edition of Radio Curious, we are now in the second interview with Lawrence Gonzalez, the author of Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, and an earlier book, Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Lawrence, I'd like your thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the groups of people who are there. One group of people who are either survivors of the Holocaust in Europe of 50 to 60 years ago, or children of those people, up against a culture that have been reported to say that if they could push the Israeli nation into the sea, they would do so.
Well, it's certainly a provocative thing to say, and I certainly can't blame the Israelis for objecting to having rockets fired into their country. But I think that conflict goes back so far in history. You know, conflicts in the Middle East of all kinds have such deep roots of one group warring with another group. And this is the history of the human race. I mean, we talked in the first interview about our ancestors of a long time ago. The default position of groups of people was to be hostile to each other. There was no rushing out to greet your strange neighbor with open arms. People killed each other. I talk in Everyday Survival about a phenomenon called groupness, described by psychologists, and it means the tendency people and other animals have to form groups in groups, and humans form in groups around almost anything. I mean, it can be your sports team, your religion, your neighborhood, anything, your nation, and once an in-group forms, it's hostile to everyone outside the group. That's the natural tendency. So we simply inherited that, and I think we're seeing it in action in the Middle East right now. And the only way around it is to use your brain, use the brain that we are lucky enough to have that's bigger than the brain of a monkey, and say, we don't have to kill each other. We can sit down and talk through this and get beyond it. And it always ends up there anyway. I mean, it seems pointless to go into these battles because you always end up at the conference table anyway.
Well, the conference table is something that is much more modern than the groupness and the battles.
Right. And the historical norm up until just a few thousand years ago was you met new people, you killed them. You know, this wasn't always the case, but it was much more the case than not. And even in modern times, Jared Diamond, who is an author of Gun, Germs, and Steel and Collapse, a bunch of books, has talked about going into New Guinea to visit with the natives there, and the fact that only in recent times has it been true that they don't kill each other when they meet strangers. He said this has turned into a situation where when two strangers meet, They enter into a long conversation to see if they can come up with some family connection that will allow them not to kill each other. So they actually spend time talking about who's related to who and who's friends with who, so they can come up with some, oh yeah, I know Aunt so-and-so, and therefore we don't have to fight and kill each other.
Are you indicating that that's a conscious change of intended behavior that is different than the way we have evolved genetically in terms of gathering territory so we can secure food and reproduce as a species?
Yeah, I mean, I think the groupness phenomenon that we talk about has its roots in the need to have resources. So if another group comes along, they're a threat to your resources. You're going to have to share. And you share with your in-group, not with the ones outside. But in more modern times, people have come to realize that killing people and being killed is not such a great thing, and there are other ways to do it because we're smart and we have language. And so even people in New Guinea who may not have overt conscious analysis of this in their heads make an effort to go beyond that instinct and say, let's find a reason why we don't have to kill each other. And the Israelis could do that with the Palestinians.
In everyday survival, you pose the question, are we doomed to do what's natural, or can we go against natural law and do better?
And I talk about thermodynamics and entropy. Thermodynamics is a fairly simple concept to get at a general level. It means if you set a hot cup of coffee on the table and ignore it, it'll get cold. Things tend to spread out. Things tend to even out. And in the process, things become more disordered. So the concentrated heat in the cup of coffee is a more ordered state than just random molecules floating all around the room. So I say, well, you know, if entropy is the law of the universe, we're pretty good at doing that because we're digging all the coal out of the ground and burning it up, and that's producing an awful lot of entropy, and maybe we're doing what just, you know, the natural thing to do is, which is to create more disorder in the world.
Even though you give an example of entropy, and the burning of coal, can you define it with perhaps another example or two?
Yes. Energy tends to flow downhill. So a classic kind of example, entropy is really a measure of a system's ability to do work. So if you have, for example, water flowing downhill and you stick a water wheel in the way, then the water will move the wheel and you can grind grain, right? You can do work with that energy motion. When the water reaches the mill pond at the end, it stops moving. It's still. It's spent all its energy, and now the only movement in there is Brownian movement. It's moving randomly. So it's gone from this ordered state where all the molecules are moving in lockstep in the same direction to this disordered state where everything is moving in every direction in terms of the molecules, and it's lost its ability to do work. If you put the water wheel in the mill pond, it won't turn. That's how, you know, basic textbooks will explain what entropy is to you.
So the water wheel requires the movement to be able to turn.
Right, and the movement is order, because all the molecules are going in the same direction. If you have just a cup of water sitting in front of you, all the molecules in it are moving, but they're all moving in different directions at once. That's why the water doesn't leap out of the cup. They're all canceling each other out.
So applied to our everyday life, how would you characterize that?
Well, what we're doing, for example, what I'm doing right now as I'm talking to you, it's probably about 15 degrees outside and there's 2 feet of snow on the ground and I'm all toasty warm. What am I doing? I'm burning natural gas. And the natural gas is heating air, and the air is being pushed around my house by an electric fan that's powered from a coal-fired plant, so I'm burning coal too. So I'm burning a huge amount of stuff, carbon fuels, and throwing a huge amount of carbon dioxide and other things into the atmosphere in order for me to stay warm. I am producing entropy as we speak. And this has a direct impact on all of our lives because the Earth is warming up as a result of so many people doing what I'm doing.
And that's the unintended consequence developing on an incremental basis that we're choosing to ignore.
Right.
In everyday survival, you talk about global warming.
Right.
Can you give us a summary of that?
Well, I talk about it, I try to talk about it as apolitically as possible, because it's not a political issue, it's an issue of human survival. There's no doubt that these things are going on right now. We started out probably 1.5 million years ago doing the same thing we're doing now, which is burning fuel. all the people who came before us burned fuel too, but there were very few people. As we became successful because of how smart we are, we were able to get more food, have more babies. The babies lived longer. Not so many of them died. And pretty soon we had 6 billion people. And when 6 billion people are doing what I'm doing, then you've got a big problem. And there has to be a way around it, because if we stopped using carbon today, like no carbon at all, which would be impossible, the Earth would still keep warming up for some time to come. And we're at about 380 parts per billion, I believe, is the number right now. The last time it was that high was before the Industrial Revolution. And it's going to head up from there. We don't know how far it will go up, and we don't know what it means. But the last time the Earth was at 500 parts per billion, there were alligators in Wyoming. And, you know, the Earth will be a very, very different place 50 years from now. And there's no indication that we're able to stop burning carbon at the rate we're burning, and indeed at a much higher rate, because, for example, in China, they're building a coal-fired electrical plant at a rate of one a week, and there's no clean coal-fired plant anywhere in the world yet. So what are we supposed to do, tell the Chinese they can't have the way of life we have? I mean, this is a very, very big problem that needs attention. I hope that people in the new administration are paying attention.
The way you characterize it in everyday survival is that the parts of carbon would not decrease, and even if they stay where they are, it creates doom for our way of life and probably for our species.
Well, I wouldn't go quite so far as to say doom. Part of the reason that I wrote Everyday Survival was because I was hoping to open the eyes of some people who might start doing things a little bit differently and perhaps slow down the rate at which these things are happening to the point where technology can catch up with what we're doing now. There's no reason in theory why you couldn't have a clean coal-fired plant, for example, and there's also no reason in theory that you couldn't get electricity from somewhere other than coal. And there are lots of alternatives. We don't need to go into them all. But right now at the Lawrence Livermore Lab, for example, they're building the world's largest laser system to ignite a controlled fusion reaction. Now, we're a long way from fusion power, but it's a start. A fusion power would be something that could answer the world's energy needs that I don't hear talked about very much, because probably it's in its infancy, and that's why. But people on an individual level can start doing things immediately to use less carbon, you know, to walk instead of driving or use public transportation, to heat their homes less. Air conditioning is one of the worst polluters of all. It pollutes twice, because you not only throw the carbon into the atmosphere, but you throw the heat from your house back into the atmosphere. And there's really, in most climates, there's really no need for it. It's just a matter of pure pleasure to have it. So there are many, many things that people can do. The packaging in the United States that we see on everything is an incredible waste of energy and completely useless. Almost anything you buy comes with some sort of heavy-duty packaging that you bring home and immediately throw away. I mean, that's really kind of shameful.
Or the ads that I receive in the mail that I don't want and I'm obligated to put in the trash.
Tons and tons of paper that you throw out every day. So there, I mean, everywhere you turn in our culture, there's a place where you can clean things up.
So my question on that is, where is a way when we throw something away?
Well, and I've thought about that a lot, and I write about it in Everyday Survival, because I really was stunned by what I learned as I was doing the research, and I began to have this terrible feeling every time I took the garbage out. It's like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? You know, I'm throwing all these manufactured goods away. And it really changed the way I handle. You know, I can't go in and eliminate the packaging industry, for example, but now I recycle everything that is even remotely recyclable. Anything that's made of any kind of plastic does not go into the trash. And it's turned out to be very interesting, because now we have tons of recycling and very little trash. The only trash we have is organic stuff, you know, like chicken bones and things like that. And in the summertime, we put the vegetable peelings and so on in a compost pile.
I remember as a child, the milk would come in a glass container,
right,
and it would be picked up, and the next week's milk would come in a similar, if not the same, glass container.
Right.
Now we break that glass down and remold it into new containers.
Right. I mean, the whole system by which we throw away containers is just completely corrupt and needs to be changed. You know, when my grandfather was in his working days and alive, he would come home from work and he would carry a bucket and he would stop at the tavern and they'd fill it with beer and he'd bring it home, a small bucket that would be the equivalent of a couple of beers. That's how people got beer at that time. And it was a totally local, fresh item that you consumed. And there was no waste at all. And there's no reason that can't happen. You know, there's also no reason that the corner grocery store that we had at that time couldn't come back into existence and service people where they were instead of people having to drive the SUV to the supermarket. So, I see a cultural shift coming by necessity. You know, if gasoline is expensive and if suburban communities are seeing houses that don't sell, you know, people may not want to move quite so much as they do now, driving everywhere. But I do think there will have to be a cultural shift for this to work.
Well, Lawrence Gonzalez, author of Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, and Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why, thanks very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting concept or idea that you've learned lately in addition to the one you mentioned on the first part of this program?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things that I have learned about is from the Santa Fe Institute, where a guy named Eric Smith is studying the origins of life and talks about how living things make thermodynamics and entropy work better. So that if you have a planet that is a hard rock planet with no life on it, like Mars, it does not degrade energy and produce entropy nearly as efficiently as a planet like Earth that has life on it. So it seems like life is actually a manifestation of a basic law of physics. And I just think that's a beautiful concept, and it's one that I talk about in Everyday Survival.
And can you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, Primo Levi's Survival in Auschwitz, which is basically just an account of what he went through there. But it's a very moving and intense account. And you get, if you read Deep Survival and see how these survivors survive, and then you read Primo Levi's Survival in Auschwitz, you see how universal these things are, because he's just the kind of guy I talk about in that book.
Well, Lawrence Gonzalez, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you for having me.
Lawrence Gonzalez is the author of Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why, and Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things. The book he recommends is Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain by Marianne Wolfe. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.